So, ja, ich soll auch mich ein bisschen entschuldigen, weil dieser Text ein bisschen zu lang ist. Also ich werde vielleicht 70 Minuten sprechen. Ich hoffe, dass ich Ihre Aufmerksamkeit holen kann. So, for some time now, I have been engaged in a project of interpreting philosophically the Pauline letters, a project from which I have published a series of essays over the last couple of years on the question of spirit, of sacrifice, and of subject formation in Paul. My philosophical interest in Paul has been stimulated by the spectacular rise of interest in his writings from philosophers in the continental tradition, notably Taubes, Badiou, Agamben, Čiček, and many others over the last two decades. However, the principal and initial impulse to devote myself to this material was the publication of the participants' lecture notes from Heidegger's early Freiburg lectures from 1920 and 21 on the phenomenology of religious life that were first made available in 1995. It was in these lectures that large parts of the existential analytic was first articulated, most notably the particular sense of the historical, das Historische, as a designation of factical and finite life in movement, claimed by and forced to respond to its situation in a critical moment, focused in particular on how this existential temporality is articulated on the basis of what Paul has to say about the parousia of Christ, his arrival or second coming. My initial idea was to discuss the implication of the fact that Heidegger articulates this historical predicament of human existence from a reading of what he, following a standard formulation of the times, simply regarded as original or primitive Christianity, Urchristentum, but that was in fact the voice and writing of a Jewish messianic reformer of ancient Judaism, deeply embedded in the prophetic literature. As Heidegger transforms the Pauline understanding of historical existence into a more general pattern for articulating the historical situatedness of human existence and thinking, he not only disconnects it from the Hebraic background, but eventually he also erases its connection to Christianity, making it into a general pattern for interpreting Dasein's relation to being. With the idea of a second beginning, an anderer Anfang, that emerges from around the time of Heidegger's partial withdrawal from public life in the mid-30s, this originally Pauline sense of history in response to the historical event of Christ is transposed into a general pattern for situating the predicament of the human spirit in the wake of modernity, nihilism, and the encompassing reign of Gestell. In that sense, Heidegger's appropriation of Paul's understanding of what it means to inhabit a tradition in crisis would be another example of what already Marlène Sarrader pointed out in her excellent book from 1990 on Heidegger and the Hebraic inheritance, La Dette impensée, to which Gérard Bensoussan also referred yesterday. The Unthought Debt, which is a study of Heidegger's repression of the Jewish spiritual roots of his own original thinking. Following the publication of the Schwarze Hefte, this line of critical interpretation has become even more pertinent and has already motivated several significant new interventions, notably by Donatella di Cesare. Adding to this, and thus moving beyond the argument and horizon of Sarrader and Cesare, I was also intrigued by the possibility of incorporating into such a discussion the profoundly ambiguous nature of the Pauline theological legacy itself and how it surfaces in Heidegger's thinking. Paul is the inventor of the historical theological matrix that eventually produces Christian anti-Semitism. In simply stating this in such a blunt manner, I'm not making any statement about guilt in this long and already too guilt-ridden history. I'm just referring to the historical and textual facts namely that it is in the letters of Paul that the idea and interpretation is first systematically articulated, according to which ancient Judaism and its constitutive law marks a surpassed historical phase in relation to what is instead taken to be its fulfilled messianic promise through the birth and sacrificial death of Christ on the cross. The original covenant between the Jewish people and its God is thus reinterpreted by Paul as the first and the old covenant in relation to its fulfillment in the second and new covenant between God and man as such. In short, when discussing Heidegger's appropriation of Paul in the context of his supposed anti-Judaism, and especially when doing so in the context of the philosophical-theological divide, we should also try to take into account the longer legacy of anti-Judaism that is part of the Pauline and Christian legacy. To navigate in a precise and responsible way on this incendiary territory is very difficult, yet it is a challenge that I think is important to assume, especially at this moment. It involves not only abstract questions of intellectual legacies and the proper handling of historical accounts, but also personal issues of sincerity, responsibility, and basic human decency. As I started to think seriously about this theme, and I was then inspired by a conference organized by friends of mine at the theology department in Lund last year, I was motivated to explore further a topic and a constellation that I had not previously written anything about, namely that between Heidegger and Bultmann and Hans Jonas, and try to understand better what had actually transpired between them, both personally, theologically, and philosophically, and more specifically, to do so through the common link of Paul. For it was not only Heidegger who, at an early stage of his life and career, found his philosophical voice and vocation in and through a reading of Paul. The first book published by Bultmann in 1910, when he was only 25, was also a study of Paul, a rhetorical study of the letters in the context of the Greek genre of the diatribe. It was also to Paul that Bultmann would return over the course of his life at decisive moments, both for intellectual reasons and for an articulation of a life in faith that he sought to live. Also, Hans Jonas started his academic career with a small book on Augustine and Paul, a book that predates by 5 years his more famous book on Gnosticism. It was published in 1926 when he too was only 25, with a dedication to Bultmann, but coming directly out of Heidegger's seminar 5 years earlier. When the three of them were again virtually united one last time after almost half a century and after the disasters that tore their world apart within the magnificent Festschrift made for Bultmann on his 85th birthday in 1970, Jonas's contribution was again a new essay on Paul, on Romans 7. So on the basis of these texts, I will present a reading that is meant to highlight some of the philosophical and theological stakes involved in these interpretive endeavors, but also connecting them in more personal terms. For in the end, the questions provoked by the topic of Heidegger and antisemitism does have an irreducible personal existential component. We can discuss at any length the increasingly obscure and arcane mathematics of the history of being, of who and what is included at what stage and not. But by the end of the day, the question of how to assess Heidegger and his views on the relation and the question of Judaism also compels us to form a conception of the man and his actions in the face of the historical situation in which he found himself, and in response to which he made his choices and shaped his fate. For this purpose, the constellation with Bultmann and Jonas carries some particularly important lessons as we seek retrospectively to make sense of what actually took place in these difficult and convulsive times. My own teacher and advisor in Stockholm, Alexander Orlovsky, who first introduced me to phenomenology and later supervised my thesis on Heidegger, had a deep personal experience of the conditions and mechanisms of totalitarianism. As the sole survivor of a Jewish-Polish family under German occupation, and as a citizen for many years in the Soviet-occupied communist Poland, he always reminded us that it's very easy to judge people's actions when you are located outside a totalitarian society. Under such circumstances, everyone has to make compromises. It is only by comparing similar people in similar situations that we can retrospectively hope to see what was indeed possible and what was not possible to do in this or that specific situation, thus forming the basis probably of a more fair judgment. In the end, it is our actions under concrete historical circumstances that reveal who we are as ethical beings, not our philosophical learnings and predilections. A very bright mind can exist in a weak and vain character, and a solid character will not necessarily come with intellectual lucidity. Comparing Heidegger and Bultmann around the time of the National Socialist Revolution is an illuminating exercise in this respect. Heidegger's early Freiburg lectures from the semester 2021 on the phenomenology of religious life is not only a remarkable piece of interpretive exegetical literature, it is, as many commentators have already pointed out, perhaps the true starting point of the adventure of the existential analytic. Heidegger comes to the Pauline text equipped with Neo-Kantian epistemology, Husserlian phenomenology, and the existentialism of Nietzsche and Kierkegaard, fusing his own writing with that of Paul, interpreting and reappropriating the text, but also letting himself be read through the text and appropriated by it. It is a blending of discourses, of phrases, words, and tonalities, where Heidegger finds himself and his own critical voice partly in and through Paul. It is here that he introduces the topic of so-called factical life experience, and that he then develops his detailed exegetical readings of the Pauline letters, notably Galatians and 1 Thessalonians, which in the next semester is followed by a close reading of sections from Augustine's Confessions. It is in these lectures on Paul that the basic form of the existential analytic, as it would later emerge in Sign on Sight, is first developed. Through the theme of factical life experience, philosophy reaches for the fundamental comportment of existence, where it lives in and through a relation with and commitment to its world. The opening pages of this course is a declaration of principle in regard to the dominant thought patterns of academic philosophy, theology, and sociology of religion. And on these first pages, he marks out his difference in relation to the liberal and Neo-Kantian way of discussing religion, either in terms of psychological feeling or in terms of a priori moral categories or historical necessity. Against Troeltsch and the dominant trends of sociology of religion, he argues for the need to approach the phenomenon of religion from a phenomenological standpoint, in its facticity, not as an object of study, but as the mode of enactment, of a Vollzug, a way of making sense. The key concept through which he chooses to enable this new mode of access to the religious and subsequently to his reading of the Pauline text is the notion of the historical, das historische, And in the detailed explication of Paul's text that then follows, he reaches into new depths of the existential temporality as a situated life in uncertain expectancy. The Paul that emerged through this reading was not the dogmatic Lutheran doctrine that traditional theology has elicited from it, through its reading of Romans in particular, but a life praxis, a mode of living comportment in and from out of which all such doctrinary conclusions must be seen as secondary. It is from within this existential situation that Paul supposedly speaks to his congregation in the making. It is a discourse animated by a heightened sense of risk, a life without certainty, and in relation to which it is even more important to open oneself to hope, to wakefulness, to resolve. In this way, Heidegger orients himself toward what he takes to be the basic existential meaning of the Pauline discourse, as characterized by a temporal horizon of the coming of Christ, of the parousia, not primarily understood in the context of a theological metaphysical dogma, but as an open horizon of lived and uncertain meaning. At the heart of this interpretation of Christian Lutheran theology is the peculiar temporal historical sense of living in a disjointed time, a time of wakefulness and resolve. It is a kairological time, from the Greek kairos, to which Paul also refers as the decisive moment. And it is in 1 Corinthians 15 that Paul first forges the metaphor of the blinking of the eye, the ripe ophthalmo, which Kierkegaard and following him Heidegger will repeat as the image for the concentrated temporality of the Augenblick, the Augenblick. In response to such an historical predicament, one can no longer simply rely on one's tradition, for this tradition has come to an end, partly through a kind of inner self-corruption and self-forgetfulness. Thus, it is necessary to dismantle its claim on us in the present and reopen the question of its possibility through more original levels of meaning. This experience of a cut or a caesura in the very fabric of history and tradition can be clearly sensed in Paul's discourse, where we read repeatedly that the law in its old form has come to an end and that it's now time to live in and through the Spirit. Heidegger's radical appropriation of the epistles merges at this point with his own sense of how the tradition of philosophy has reached an impasse, and that there is a need of a destruction of the very legacy of the Western metaphysics, as we read in Sign on Sight 6 years later. There are multiple motives behind this drastic imagery, but it is again Paul who first states that in relation to the previous tradition, it must be destroyed. Whereas it literally says in Corinthians 10, I destroy buildings of thought, logismos katairontes, or in the Latin translation, concilia destruentes. This sense of a crisis in tradition and of the necessity of something starting anew also motivates the program of destruction in Heidegger's thinking. It is a project that it is at once destructive, critical, and constructive, since its ultimate purpose is not negative, but positive. It seeks to retrieve lost and unthought possibilities in previous philosophical systems, and ultimately to access that very same tradition as for the very first time. And perhaps most importantly, it outlines a sense of subjectivity that is no longer a master of itself, but exposed and in its historical finitude open to a possibility, having to live awake and prepared without certainty. The impact of Heidegger's reading and hermeneutic mode of accessing the early Christian texts can be seen in the students that followed this course and in his friendship with Bultmann that followed immediately after his move to Marburg in 1924. Their correspondence from these years provide a testimony of the deep sense of affinity that developed between them as they quickly moved from the polite "sie" to the more intimate "du" of friendship that would last throughout their lives, also after long interruptions. Many of the letters are concerned with academic business, with forged and broken alliances, and much of it is simply short and private words of friendship. But between the lines and in some of the letters, the deeper philosophical issues surface, as in a letter from March 29th, 1927, where Heidegger describes them as approaching Christianity from two very distinct positions. Bultmann from that of a specifically Christian ontic, where the ontological is played down, whereas Heidegger comes from the inverse position, the ontological, in relation to which the specifically Christian is toned down. This letter recalls the main points of the only principal text that Heidegger will ever write on the topic of phenomenology and theology, composed precisely around this time, and that he presented as a lecture in 1927, and which he then dedicated to Bultmann when it was published in a separate edition more than 40 years later in 1970. In this essay, he stresses the fundamental difference between the two types of intellectual practice, locating theology among the positive sciences and designating its positive content as the explication of a life in faith. In contrast, philosophy is a discipline that is concerned with being, and in virtue of this preoccupation, it is clearly and even decisively distinct from any of the other positive sciences, be they physics or theology. Yet, at the same time, philosophy has the ability and perhaps even the responsibility to explore and clarify the ontological concepts and phenomena that underlie the concepts used to articulate a life in faith. And later from the same year, there is a letter from Heidegger in response to a demand from Bultmann concerning an article that the latter has been asked to write on Heidegger's philosophy and its importance for theology. And Heidegger there summarizes the basic sources of his own thinking in a few sentences, and among them stressing that Augustine, Luther, Kierkegaard sind philosophisch wesentlich für die Ausbildung eines radikaleren Daseinsverständnis. Here Paul is no longer mentioned by name, but his legacy is clearly implicitly affirmed as part of the inner inheritance of the existential analytic. 5 years later, in 1932, Bultmann writes a new essay on Paul, on Romans 7 and the anthropology of Paul. I want to stop for a moment just to mention a few points from this somewhat marginal essay that points to important events in the year that follow. Bultmann's main message is that Paul's anthropology is not a subjectivism, but one that must be understood on the basis of his historical existence, his geschichtliche Sein. Man is not divided between a good and pure spirit and a bad and corrupt body, but man is division, Zwiespalt, where what is at stake is always his authenticity, his Eigentlichkeit. The only salvation lies in the moment and how he lives the moment, the Augenblick. Therefore, it is not a question of following the letter of the law, but to seek out its basic intuition, its Anschauung, that leads to life. In the end, man must abandon himself to the address of God, his Anspruch. The same year, on December 11th, 1932, Bultmann writes a long letter to Heidegger that gives us a glimpse into the sentiments and political orientations at this critical moment in history. Initially, he describes in some detail his work on the concepts of pistis and kerygma and how these are now the central questions for theology today. Then suddenly, he poses the question, if it is indeed true, as he has been told, that Heidegger has joined the party. He admits that he holds certain hopes for the movement, but as it develops into a party, he sees only the corruption that misleads students into becoming local Führers, and he finds it hard to envision Heidegger in the company of some of these people. Heidegger responds within a few days to this letter, on December 16th. And to begin with, he declares again that their way of approaching theology is different, that for him it's a question of helping theology to awaken itself through the means of a philosophical reflection, a besinnung. Then, on the topic of his suspected party membership, he replies as follows. That I should be a member of the NSDAP, that is a smell from the latrines, as they say in the military, a latrinengeruch. He admits that he has received several requests to join, and then he retorts, I am not a member of this party, I will never be a member of this party, just as I never was a member of any other party. Ich bin nicht Mitglied dieser Partei, werde es nie sein, so wenig wie ich früher Mitglied irgendeiner anderen gewesen bin. Having made his declaration, he then admits that he too is positive in regard to much in it, in very much the same sense that he takes Bultmann to have articulated in his letter. After this letter from December 32, there is no significant preserved exchange until June 33, 6 months later, in the meantime of which history has turned and the two men made their choices. In April 33, Heidegger is elected as the new rector of Freiburg University under the auspices of the new National Socialist regime, as one of the most high-profile intellectuals to step forth as a representative of the new government. From the Schwarze Hefte, we have the unique testimony of his own inner doubts, as he writes in an undated note from around this time, of how this choice fills him with the sense of having perhaps betrayed his conscience. But on May 27, he presents his rectoral address, in which he speaks for the need for resolution of affirming the German destiny, the great new outbreak, the Ausbruch, and the need for spiritual guidance and leadership, and finally to affirm its rootedness in the original beginning of Greek philosophy. A few weeks after this speech, he receives again a letter from Bultmann. The latter has not read the full speech. He has just read transcripts of parts of it in the newspaper. The tone of Bultmann's letter is restrained, contorted, troubled. He says that he lacks the strength to affirm the moment in a similar way, and that he seeks his strength elsewhere, in their shared sources, in Kierkegaard, not surprisingly, but also in Nietzsche. He sees the present as characterized by a hybris, behind which he detects a hidden anxiety, a verdeckten Angst. His words of farewell resonate with both concern for and estrangement vis-à-vis his friend. Considering what you now have to carry, and from out of concern, if you have chosen the right place and time to involve yourself, I send you my wishes. Aus der Erwägung dessen, was du zu tragen hast, und aus der Sorge, ob du dich an der rechten Stelle und am rechten Zeitpunkt eingesetzt hast, schicke ich dir meine Wünsche. After this letter, there are only occasional short messages, interrupted by a plea from Bultmann to Heidegger in 35 to engage himself against a further attack on the university, on which there is no preserved response from Heidegger. Then suddenly there is a letter from Heidegger from 1939 where he declares, "What is happening now is not history in the essential sense. What takes place is Machenschaft. The partial closing of the university is perhaps not such a bad thing after all, considering that it is groundless and without reflexive capacity. Besinnungsfeig. Instead, it all hinges on the capacity to prepare what is coming after what is now, through a reflection on what endures, durch die Besinnung auf das, was standhält." After this lonely and belated realization of where things are going, and its hope in some sort of reflexive resistance, there is no preserved contact until the mid-50s, when it is again resumed, and mostly in the form of polite greetings. In his response to Heidegger's surprising turn in the spring of 33, and the choice to invest his philosophy and its personal prestige in support of Hitler and National Socialism, Bultmann speaks in convoluted terms, expressing his disappointment in indirect ways. However, earlier, in the very same month that Heidegger gives his rectoral address, Bultmann also addresses his students in a smaller circle, but also in a public event, speaking of the task in the present, not the task of philosophy and of science as such, but the task of theology and of theologians. Here, Bultmann too speaks of Besinnung, of responsibility, and of the specific responsibility of theologians for developing the sense and meaning of a Christian faith for our generation. It is remarkable to read this lecture alongside Heidegger's rectoral address and to see how Bultmann uses the very same language from Sein und Zeit and its analysis of facticity, at times even verbatim. God as creator does not mean that man is determined by eternal principles, he says, but through the concrete situation of the moment, of the Augenblick. This means that we find ourselves in our situation. In this situation, the belief in God and in the sense of a people, of a Volkstum, can stand in a positive relation, even in a destinal community, in a Gemeinschaft des Schicksals. God is not immanent in the world. Instead, he occupies a distance, the same distance that Paul is said to have articulated when speaking of the hos me, the not as. And Bultmann cites 1 Corinthians, stating that faith is not a negative relation to the world, but a positive attitude that is nevertheless critical. From the perspective of faith, we can see how man always wants to control and rule over creation, and that he forgets that he himself is created, mistaking himself for its creator, thus making himself guilty of sin. This is then followed by the open declaration that no state and no nation is so pure as to allow itself to take its will directly from God. From every people can arise both beauty and nobility, but in every people it is also possible that the demonic and the sinful can erupt. From Christian faith and from the Pauline message, it should thus be possible to draw a critical force that can preserve a living reflection, a Besinnung, and that can find a sense of love through the experience of grace. Bultmann then lists in very clear terms what he sees as the problems and the risks of the present time, the denunciations, the defamations, and the repressions of free speech. And then at the very end, he speaks out in no ambiguous terms. Ich muss als Christ das Unrecht beklagen, dass gerade auch den deutschen Juden durch solche Diffamierung angetan werde. As a Christian, I must deplore the injustice done to the German Jews through such defamations. This is what it was also possible to say in May 33. This is what it was also possible to say in May 33 on the very basis of the same existential analytic of the finitude of human existence, through the very same matrix of thought that Heidegger a few weeks later would activate in his support of the National Socialist seizure of power and its new university politics. From Hans Jonas' obituary for Bultmann, written in 1976, we have another glimpse of the man from this same period. Jonas recalls, with lucid and deeply moving words, how he came to see Bultmann and his family one last time in this same summer, 1933. The only friend to whom he paid a visit before leaving Germany for good. He recounts how, in response to his own report of how Jews were now even being excluded from the society for the blind, he looked at Bultmann and saw how a deathly pallor had spread over his face. At that point, he writes, he knew that in matters of elementary humanity, one could simply rely on Bultmann. To this anecdote, Jonas adds the story of how he, upon his return to Germany after the capitulation, dressed in British military gear, came to visit the Bultmann family unannounced, and how he was greeted with words and tears, and with the immediate question if it was indeed the second volume of his Gnosis that he was carrying with him. This meeting, he describes, restored in him the sense of the possibility of the constancy of thought and the loving interest across the ruin of a world. Heidegger's continued work and development from the mid-30s onward up until the end of the war, is remarkable and an almost unfathomable story in itself. This is the time of his great Auseinandersetzung with Nietzsche, two volumes from which were published in the early 60s, that provoked a whole new chapter in the reception of Nietzsche's work. It is the time of his work on the early Greek philosophy and on German idealism. It is the attempt to forge a new form of philosophical, non-positing, non-objectifying discourse, manifested most clearly in the Beiträge. It is a period of extraordinary productivity, a laboratory of thought that has kept his readers and interpreters busy for more than half a century. Last, but not least, it is the time of his profound engagement with Hölderlin. During these years, it is clear, not least from the Schwarze Hefte, how he sees the entire Western civilization as doomed by machination, nihilism, and calculative thinking, and how he places his hopes in Hölderlin and the possibility of a second beginning in relation to the first Greek beginning, a mythico-poetical return of a possibility that was somehow lost or betrayed along the way. All of this is accompanied by an increasingly sharp critique of Christianity, of the Church, and of Judaism. which here blend into one historical entity, a kind of historical fall from grace or betrayal that it is the task for thinking to somehow repair. In the previously published text on this topic, notably by Träge, there is no real discussion of Christianity and Judaism. The second beginning, das andere Anfang, is there simply articulated in relation to a Greek first beginning. It is only now in these recently published hefte that this, the historical other of this cultural revolution is mentioned by name, Judaism, and in the context of Christianity. A decisive inspiration for this whole diagnosis and of its cure is, of course, Nietzsche, whose analysis of nihilism takes its point of departure in the historical invention of monotheism and in a world defined in moral terms, in an ethical metaphysics. If we are to locate the immediate and overall intellectual matrix within which Heidegger's discourse during these years can be situated and possibly understood, I think we should first look to Nietzsche's critique of Jewish-Christian religion, combined with a Hölderlinian hope for deeper unification with the lost Greek origin. But Heidegger's dream is not one of a return in the perhaps more naive sense of earlier generations of German classicists and Hellenophiles. The ancient world is gone. It will not return. What awaits us is the possibility of beginning anew, or even of being ourselves a beginning, precisely in the form of a second beginning. This is also the formulation that we find in the darkest, most shocking quotations from the Schwarze Hefte, the paragraph from 1942 that includes the statement that what is happening now is the self-annihilation, the Selbstvernichtung of the Jews. The very same year that the German state has opted for the final solution, murder on industrial scale, as its response to the so-called Jewish problem, Heidegger, sitting alone, all his Jewish friends, colleagues, and teachers long gone, thinking that the Jews are now somehow murdering or destroying themselves. The sheer horror of this remark repels us from even trying to interpret it. And yet it has, from the viewpoint of the conceptual castle that Heidegger has built for himself, an inner consistency and logic. If nihilism, the emptying of all values, the transformation of the world into one great machination and device of power and control, is the belated effect of Christian moral metaphysics, with Christianity being the extension of Judaism, well, then what is happening out in the streets, in the industrial factories of death, are Jews killing Jews. The world has become one great device of mechanization and power, and all we can hope for is another beginning. So what can we do? Well, he says, we should not try to write histories of the West. Instead, we should try to be more Western, more Abendländisch, which he then specifies as anfänglicher denn Anfang anfangen lassen, to let the beginning begin in a more original way. And this should take place, he explicitly declares, äußerhalb des Judentums und das heißt Christentums, beyond Judaism, including Christianity. Was Bultmann ever aware of where Heidegger was going in his mind during these dark years? What would he have said? Would their friendship have survived the knowledge of where his thinking had taken him? While Heidegger is lashing out against Christianity, the organized churches, Judaism, Bultmann is risking his own position through his involvement in the confessional church, the Bekennende Kirche, the Lutheran congregations that were shaped as response to Hitler's attempt to co-opt the church into a state, National Socialist Church. In 1941, Bultmann had given another critical sermon where he spoke out against what was happening to the church, mobilizing against Christianity as a potential source of resistance. In this sermon, he notes that many of the churches are destroyed, and finally he declares, Germany is no longer a Christian nation. For Bultmann, his Christianity, his faith, his never-failing reliance in a fundamental Pauline spirituality seems to have served him through the dark years and given him the resources to resist, at least in himself and in his proximity, the ongoing destruction of human dignity and its basic ethical political orientation. For him, it was a message of love and care for the other through grace that took him through the years of increasing isolation and despair. Heidegger too despaired during these years. From approximately 1935 onward, it is clear, and even more so I would say through the publication of the Hefte, that he saw himself as in isolation and in opposition. The letter from 1939 to Bultmann that I quoted, the last one before the long silence, one that may even have involved a certain risk in sending, I cannot judge, clearly shows him taking his distance to what was happening. But whereas Bultmann finds spiritual support in the Pauline text and his Christian faith, Heidegger openly, or at least to himself, rejects the entire spiritual legacy of Paul and of Judaism, of Christian spirituality generally, and of institutional faith in particular. And yet, we cannot refrain from stating again the question with which I began, namely, from where does Heidegger draw his hopes in this second and other beginning? It is repeatedly stated that it's a Greek beginning. It's always named as a Greek beginning. It is supposedly a question of returning directly to that particular historical promise. But what does it mean to read history, to interpret and decipher history as the possibility of a return and of a new beginning? From where does such a trope or figure of thought even appear? Certainly not in any Greek philosophical sources, where such mode of temporality and historical promise are not to be found. No. It is in the Jewish prophetic and messianic literature generally, and most radically expressed in Paul, that the very shape of history, in which Heidegger here places his hopes for the future, is first configured. It is Paul who forges the image of history as the inner death and the inner decomposition of tradition, and the possibility of a new birth, a second beginning, a new covenant. It seems to me impossible not to see Heidegger's radical, distorted, apocalyptic ruminations during these years as also animated by precisely that tradition that he, according to a perverse logic of repression, refuses to recognize as even belonging to the history of being, or belonging to precisely that history of being, the form of which is inconceivable without the messianic and kairological sense of time that is most forcibly articulated in the Pauline letters. This remark is not only valid for the basic form of his messianic historical schema, it is also true of the basic ethical orientation of his thinking from the mid-30s onward, where he begins to distance himself from a philosophy of subjectivity, of will, of power, of control, opting instead for the primacy of hearing, of belonging, of being addressed, and of the Ereignis, and of the experience of the unpredictable event. But where again, if not in the prophetic and Pauline literature, do we first locate these tropes? It was never incidental that the theologians were so attracted and continued to be attracted to Heidegger's thinking, for it remains firmly situated within the discursive, effective, and dare we even say ontological context of the Jewish prophetic messianic literature. How then can we make sense of this situation? How can we both see Heidegger moving more deeply into the reservoirs of Jewish spirituality while openly denying the significance of this very same heritage, indeed, while openly siding with the most brutal expression of its expulsion? Or is this also a Pauline inheritance? Is Heidegger's anti-Judaism itself somehow an extension of the Jewish anti-Jewishness, of a certain reversal in the very thinking of the Jewish tradition itself, in its most strange appearance? To give us a further impetus to reflect on this question, I now turn to the last section of my talk. And I know I've spoken for... Okay, I still have my 10 minutes that I promised, so... I've spoken long. So, we have one more important text to revisit, without which this entire discourse loses its edge and purpose. It's an analysis that permits us to sense and to locate the fundamentally ambiguous standing and repercussion of the Hebraic inheritance in this convoluted history. I'm thinking of a text that I mentioned briefly at the outset, namely, an essay on Paul and Romans 7 that Hans Jonas composed as his contribution to the Festschrift for Bultmann in 1970. The title of this essay, as it was published in English a few years later, is The Abyss of the Will. It's a short essay, not even 15 pages. But over these pages, it concentrates a personal, philosophical, theological, but also historical drama in a uniquely dense manner. It opens again with an expression of personal gratitude to Bultmann for his friendship during times when, as Jonas writes, and leaving no doubt about who is implied, many other bonds were broken and irretrievably lost in the dark abyss of our time. He then recapitulates what it was that he accomplished back then, around 1930, 40 years earlier, namely, an existential analysis of the Pauline self-experience as it finds expression in Romans 7. The formulation in these passages were at the heart of the Pelagian struggle concerning the freedom of the will that also involved Augustine and later, of course, Luther. It is in Paul that we should look for the heart of this matter, as he speaks not only for an historical contingent group, but of how the failure of the law holds for the pagan and the Christian no less than for the Jew. To articulate an existential reading of this problem, that was the topic of my early work, Jonas says. Now he wants to try the idea if there is a primal sin, as discussed by Paul and Augustine, as something that is inevitably committed and constantly renewed, as somehow rooted in the manner of movement of the human will itself. If this is the case, then it should be sought in the experience of an insufficiency that springs from the ontology of human existence as such. Only on this condition, he writes, do the Pauline statements have the validity that they claim. In other words, only if we are able to translate the theological message back into a comprehensible existential form can it carry its own genuine message. And then he cites the full opening of Romans. What we have here. All thinking and acting, Jonas says, is reflexive. We know what we think and we will. Volo me velle. The will, he writes, is a priori always there, underlying all single acts of the soul. The will that performs this permanent decision, or rather that exists as its performance, is nothing other than the fundamental mode of being of Dasein in general. In brief, he adds, a will signifies what Heidegger explicates under the head the concept of care, of Sorge. Indeed, ultimately all phenomena of morality, of freedom, choice, responsibility, conscience, and guilt, are said to be rooted in this primordial reflexiveness as the ontological basis of freedom. This apparently innocent hermeneutical gesture, using Heidegger's conceptual apparatus for an exegetical course, is on one level trivial. It was done often. It had been done. It would be done. In theology, no less than in literature, psychology or anthropology. But here the stakes are different. Here the stakes are very much higher. Here it is Hans Jonas, the American philosopher, the uncompromising Zionist warrior, who, returning in a virtual form to Germany to pay tribute to his Lutheran teacher through a reading of Paul of Romans 7, with the purpose of proving the universal existential validity of his message, who at this very moment again leaves the word to Heidegger, without whose thinking this interpretive exercise would be unfeasible. Still, we are not at the real center of the argument, for more is to come. In order to show the existential validity of Paul's thinking, we must also account for the necessary failure of freedom, its inevitable ensnarement in itself. For the freedom of the will must also be the unfreedom of the will, in order that the insufficiency thesis be not simply, as Nietzsche had ridiculed, a mere slander of man. The will has the capacity to step back and objectify and subjugate the world. But in doing so, it ultimately objectifies also itself, making it into its own object. However, in doing so, when the will makes itself into a contemplated object, it forsakes its inner humility and it replaces its unmediated creatureliness for the pride of mediacy. It leaves its spontaneous willing of itself and makes itself instead into the object of its will, side-glancing, comparing itself with others. Instead of living its act, it becomes the observable actor. And Jonas then asks the rhetorical question, shouldn't this be at least one meaning, perhaps the minimal as well as the fundamental meaning of the Pauline idea of self-glorying in one's work? The point is then that this self-glorying objectification of oneself is a trap that freedom sets for itself. It is even said to be caused by a law that is not external but internal, not heteronomous but autonomous, using Kant's terminology. To break the self-mirroring of the subject in relation to itself, the hyperbolic sense of its will must somehow be contained. It must pause itself. It must come to see itself in its inner non-sufficiency. For Kant, the solution lies in autonomy, in a will that refuses all external adaption and that only wills itself. Yet even this understanding of the problem contains a risk. For in the thought of a pure autonomy, this pure inwardness produces for itself, through a self-objectification, where it says to itself, I am the will that wills myself and my own law, a kind of self-recompense, which, also known under the name of vanity, is no less corrupting than the counting of a return from outside. And possibly even more corrupting, since it can be enjoyed without delay in the very performance of its act. I am autonomous. I am the law. I fulfill the law. I contain my own will. Do you see what Jonas is saying here? He's basically accusing Kantian morality for leaving the way to a kind of hubris and vanity of a will that relishes in its own ability to will itself. And in its place, he puts the deeper dichotomy of the authentic and the inauthentic as a way to describe the basic existential antinomy of the moral reality as such. And independently, he says, of all theories concerning the ground of the moral norm. And putting it in brief terms, he adds, the antinomy means that under the condition of human ambiguity, the attempt at holiness of the will condemns itself to an unholy will. And he ends the exposition as follows. It is my opinion that this antinomy stands behind the despair of the Pauline self-description. This gesture is again monumental. What Jonas is doing is to celebrate his Lutheran, Kantian, existential teacher by disparaging Kant and the rational ethics of the Enlightenment with the help of the tools that he has obtained from his National Socialist philosophy teacher, who is the only one who can help him to properly read the Jewish existential thinker, Paul, who himself is both the original architect of anti-Judaism and yet the first who was able to truly articulate the fundamental ethical in man. In this moment, what we normally take for granted as stable begins to tremble. And yet there is a deeper consistency in this. And this is what this extremely complicated situation forces us to think. We should not fail to miss that it was precisely the vanity, this Eitelkeit of the will, that the Pauline Bultmann accused Heidegger of having succumbed to in his rectoral address. That it was this hubris of the will to power, the will to decision, the will, that Heidegger himself would also later place in question, when he withdrew into his turning in the mid-30s, and that he would again repeat in the Letter on Humanism. Indeed, it was to this Pauline Lutheran, and dare we now say, Jewish intellectual roots, that Heidegger too returned in a desperate and in the end historically confused attempt to find a way out of nihilism and machination, arguing that it would be possible to invent it anew on the basis of a somehow purified Greek legacy, explicitly without connection to the Jewish Christian inheritance that had once permitted him to articulate these thoughts. In Jonas's reading, Jesus is the one who exposes the bad piety of the law, whereas Paul's critique strikes at all piety of the law. Jesus condemns from outside a false and corrigible attitude. Paul, on the other hand, describes from within a true and inevitable experience. In Jonas's reading, Paul has seen through not only the bad Pharisee, but also the good Pharisee, the one that relishes in his capacity to will and to follow the law. This is why he has to be led to the experience of a deeper dialectic of standing under the condition under the law. The Pharisee has not yet found grace, for he has not recognized that he is a sinner also for and under the law. What Jesus takes into consideration is the lowest form of legality, the hypocritical inability to live and incorporate the law. What Paul does, however, is to seek out the highest mode of law piety for his critical object by pointing out an inner difference in the very existential premise. By showing that we cannot will ourselves as lawful, we must recognize our inner finitude also before the law. Do you see again what this means? It means that Jesus is Kant and Paul is Heidegger. And that it's Heidegger who gets the last word, as the one who has seen through the inner disunity of the subject before the law. Of the two, Paul is the deeper thinker, a deeper thinker than Christ, a deeper Jewish thinker. Yet, Jonas adds, the death of Christ on the cross has no rightful place in Jesus' own message. From the perspective of Jesus, all men have immediate access to God and a genuine being before him, as long as they hear and heed his call. This statement, Jonas then says, reiterates the old, if much disputed, proposition that Paul's message about Jesus as the crucified Christ signifies a decisive step beyond Jesus' own message, a step through which the paths of the old creed and the new really part. I'm on my last page now. And to make this as clear as possible, Paul is the deeper existential thinker, but through his unwarranted historical metaphysical interpretation of the death of Christ on the cross, he has passed beyond his means. Indeed, he has gone beyond the tradition of a deep ethical wisdom that made his message possible in the first place. This is the conclusion of Jonas's reading. Jonas does not say so himself, and probably he does not even see it fully. But through this last gesture, when he sort of in the last moment takes his distance with regard to Paul as a metaphysician of history, he could also be seen as having summarized Heidegger and his strange and ultimately misguided trajectory. The Pauline Heidegger, the genuine existential Pauline Heidegger, has a philosophical anthropology that runs deeper than the Jesus-like Kant, a Kant that he also connects Bultmann with, saying repeatedly often that Bultmann was a little bit too Kantian. Yet, in his attempt to break out of the history of metaphysics, and through his transformation and reversal of history, after which there is no longer any place for Judaism, into a history where the human spirit should somehow begin anew, in a second beginning, perhaps in a second covenant with being. Heidegger has committed an unjustified gesture in relation to his own background, as well as in relation to his own deepest thought, in a way that imitates, in a strange and contorted way, a movement of thought already enacted in Paul himself. In Paul, we find a profound articulation of the human ethical predicament. In Paul, we also find a refiguration of history in his messianic fantasy of history beginning entirely anew, leaving the old behind, transforming the historically contingent death of his ethical hero into a world historical and redemptive event, thereby dividing humanity in a definitive before and after, and thereby unknowingly anticipating the exclusion of his own people from its own continued tradition. We are indeed on contested territory. Thank you.